We gather this morning to continue a conversation that we began two Sundays ago, to build off of the theme of what it means to be a people of wonder, and to answer the two often asked questions by Unitarian Universalists and non-UUs alike. What do Unitarian Universalists believe? As I reminded the folks two Sundays ago who were new, you might be surprised to hear us asking that question in this space in which we are Unitarian Universalists. But hopefully what you will hear is that because it is an evolution, it is an often asked question. And then there's a second question that we are also going to unpack a little bit today, and that is from our longer-term members who are here at UUCWC. What on earth are you telling those newcomers at Roots? 2 hours of history and theology, and they are still coming back. We will not be here for 2 hours. This is the second part. And just as a building off of what I heard from many of you two Sundays ago, you are all more than welcome to join me at any of the Roots conversations every other month at any time, whether you are newcomer, long-term member, or friend. Please, please, please come and join us. Now, if you recall, two Sundays ago, we took on a lot of our Unitarian roots. Unitarians and Universalists were two completely different Christian denominations. We talked about the contextual nature of answering who Jesus was and how powerful that answer came to be in the history, not only for Unitarianism and Universalism, but in terms of power and rule. And if you don't know what I'm talking about because you weren't here those two Sundays ago, that's okay. I promise we're not going to stick too much in that space, and there's always the CDs and the podcasts. I shared with you then the story of Michael Servetus, who, when reading the Bible in its original languages, found no proof of the Holy Spirit or the Trinity. He became known for and then killed for his written works against Trinitarianism, and therefore the first to articulate Unitarianism, one, not three. We then finished with the story of King Sigismund and his minister, Francis David, who said, "We need not think alike to love alike," and how David was imprisoned and then killed for his radical free thinking. Those were some of the stories of our roots of Unitarianism throughout Europe. But today we venture deeper into Unitarianism in America and Universalism here too. And this is when the stories, in my opinion, get even better. So two Sundays ago, we began in the years after Jesus' birth and then death. Today, we begin in the New World, in what will become the United States in the 1700s. So first, we have to ask, who are we? What's going on? Where are we in the 1700s in the New World? Just tell me, what's happening? Okay, that almost worked. Say it a little bit louder and more confident this time. Revolutionary War, slave trade, colonialism, an entire people leaving England to escape a certain kind of religious government only to wonder who they are and then replicate much of what they tried to leave. It's a time of formation, right? Yes? Okay. I knew you were saying it. I just couldn't hear it. So you know already the story of the first man that we have to mention, John Murray. We have a John Murray Sunday every last Sunday in September every year. And so I know that you already know the story, but let me remind you a little bit about John Murray. He is an English Calvinist. And remember, John Calvin from the Servetus story, a Calvinist, believes in predestination, a previously determined fate for your afterlife, a focus on sin and limited atonement or limited forgiveness, and the election of who receives such forgiveness and eternal afterlife. John Murray is a strong Calvinist until he meets his neighbor woman down the street, a woman who is rumored to be what's called a Universalist, someone who believes that God is too good to damn what that God has created. Does that make sense? Someone who believes that God is of limitless forgiveness, not limited forgiveness, and that the argument of needing to know Jesus and believe in him limited God's capacities and capabilities for the higher power that she and other universalists believed in. Now, after debating with this woman, Murray wrote in his journal, and I just love this, "From this point on, I carefully avoided universalists." He was so shaken to his core that he couldn't deny the universalist thought and message, and that he had begun to question his once Calvinist theology. In response, Murray is excommunicated from his entire community. Remember that your parish, your church, is also your town. Parishes were communities, not just sanctuaries. He's excommunicated from his parish, all while his wife and child both become ill and die. His finances are in shambles from medical bills. We know that story. He is thrown into debtor's prison, and after trying to take his own life, his debts are forgiven only if Murray promises to go off to America, which he does. A lifeboat, he thinks. But also a life of punishment, he thinks, from a God that has broken him for preaching universalism. The story continues that Murray's boat, headed to New York, crashes in New Jersey, good luck, New Jersey, and that's actually the name of the town, and while there meets a man who has been waiting for someone to come and preach just the message Murray speaks of. And of course, Murray's terrified to do so, believing himself to be punished for doing exactly this. But he agrees to preach to this working class, beaten downtown in which the threat of a life of damnation after a life of hard labor or slavery is punishment enough. If the winds don't change by Sunday in 3 days' time, he'll preach, he says. But if the boat can be fixed before and Murray can get out of New Jersey, no promises of Sunday worship. The story, of course, ends that come Sunday, Murray in the pulpit as promised, and just as he speaks of this radical, forgiving, and loving God, the winds change. The town is converted. The universalist God is alive in New Jersey, and Murray then hops on his boat, travels north, having done what was intended, and the universalist spark and message travels throughout the Northeast. Now, that's in the late 1700s. At the same time that universalism is set afire within poor, enslaved, and working class communities, there is another man on the scene in the Northeast named William Ellery Channing. Do we know this name? Just lie to me. Yes, okay. You do. I know you do. Channing's beginnings and surroundings could not be any more different than John Murray's and the people that he was preaching to. He is born to an elite family of judges and lawyers. Channing, who is the Murray equivalent for our American Unitarianism, becomes incredibly important and popular after preaching what's called the Baltimore Sermon at the ordination of a colleague. Before explaining this further, there's a really important point that we need to make sure we understand. The Universalists, John Murray, universal salvation. The Universalists are Christians at this time. They are not fighting over the Trinity like we talked about two Sundays ago, about who Jesus is in relation to God. They were good with him being a part of and equal to God. Channing, however, of the Unitarian perspective and his colleagues are having an entirely different debate about Christianity. They aren't so focused on an afterlife as much as they are questioning the divinity of Jesus, looking at the rationality of his resurrection and including the scientific advances all around them. Do you hear that distinction? Afterlife, but Jesus is God. Universalism. Jesus is human, or we wonder what kind of divinity he holds, but there's definitely still selection and election about an afterlife, Unitarianism. Those are two very different questions that they're taking on. And two very different ways of pulling away from what was Christianity. The word Unitarian at this time is still an insult. And it's flung from every corner of the street until Channing, until this Baltimore sermon in which he took on two tasks. First, Channing said that he insisted that there was a valid and necessary practice of interpreting Scripture, not just for belief, but for the understanding and the meaning of the text. And the second task, well, let's pause there for a second. Can you imagine how radical that is? That you have to insist that the text can be interpreted. This is the first moment in our biblical culture where we can ask what this means, where translations are being pulled into thought, where different interpretations are being offered, meaning is being explored. This is a huge moment. The second task that Channing lifted up was simply to articulate a clear and reasoned Unitarian Christianity, a term never before used proudly or as a platform. Unity, not Trinity. Moral perfection of God. Think about what that phrase means. Moral perfection of God, which negated sin and eternal suffering. Christ as fully human, so Jesus, not Christ. His death for atonement, not for atonement, but his life for inspiration. And finally, moral conscience of humans given by God to humans to be used and not suppressed for belief's sake. I mean, this could be radical in some communities still today, yes? Salvation by character was Channing's catchphrase. And this was a game changer. For two decades after this Baltimore sermon, Unitarianism saw radical growth as it was declared and worn proudly for the very first time. So you can hear how Christianity, so set in defined terms by the Nicene Creed we talked about last time, so defined, was being questioned and redefined all alongside our national formation of questioning and redefining. You hear how those echo one another, right? The formation of America alongside the questions and formation of what it means to be Christian. But the questions and the wonder didn't stop here. A few more names for you. Are you all still with me? Yes? Okay. We're going to jump to the mid-1800s, and many of you I know the household name of Ralph Waldo Emerson. What many don't know is that Emerson was actually an ordained Unitarian minister who held a pulpit in Massachusetts. And Emerson is actually one of my favorite characters and stories in our history because he is the start of what is called our Transcendentalist movement. Transcendentalist, transcend, to go outside of or beyond. While preaching, Emerson comes to realize, so this would be like if all of a sudden I came to realize that I interviewed with you, you called me all under the pretense that I had this specific theology, and then while with you, Emerson came to realize that much of his connection with the holy is actually not only found within the Bible. And it is certainly outside of the four walls of his sanctuary, and it is largely in community and in conversation and with nature. He begins to preach these transcendentalist leanings, and his people love it. It is about this world, the mysticism and ongoing revelation found in the natural world. His congregation, all under the name of Unitarianism, grows and grows, and with it, Emerson's frustrations grow too, because he is becoming less enthralled with Christianity and more in love with something outside of it. His people are following suit, and he can't understand. You don't need me, he preaches one Sunday morning to them. You don't need this text. You don't need this place. And so they keep coming. When When the Unitarian traditionalists, the folks holding on to Christianity and Unitarianism as a Christian tradition, hear about Emerson's preaching, they try to strip him of his ministerial title, of his full ordination. But here's the beauty. He has converted so many folks to Unitarianism, which is really Unitarian Transcendentalism or Transcendental Unitarianism. They can't do it. The influence is so big that there are now people, communities of people, saying they are Unitarian, but describing something larger than and outside of Christianity. See what's happening? Okay. Keep going. If we go 100 years further, we did the 1700s and the 1800s. Now we're in the early and mid-1900s. Where are we in America? What's happening? Give me between 1910 and 1960. War. I mean, we can just say war, right? And we can name them. End of World War I, not long after is World War II, and then not long after that is the Cold War, saying nothing of our domestic war with the Jim Crow America. And so it goes. We are in a time in which we cannot hide from the devastation that humans have caused and participated in. People from the secular to the pastors across denominations, people are starting to ask, why are we looking to a God to save us from the ugliness that we humans have caused? And from this question, from this wonder, two or three strains of what is called humanism comes out of this time. Secular humanism, there is no God and there is no need for religion. That is not us. And then two forms of religious humanism, both coming out of Unitarian ministers, John Dietrich and Curtis Rees. Dietrich's religious humanism never rejects theism, never rejects the idea of God. He just doesn't want it to interfere with the agency and the power of humans to make positive change in the world. Whereas Rees, his religious humanism, believed the universe was self-existing and rejected any idea of a higher power. Still religious, but not God-based. The debate of humanism versus theism is widespread throughout both Unitarianism and Universalism, and still today in some UU congregations. This and the decades after is what we call the death of God movement. Do any of you, you're going to date yourself, remember the Time magazine cover? Yeah, the death of God movement. And I think it was very stark black with red letters, is God dead? And like Emerson, whose rank in the Unitarian space is threatened because of this religious humanism and religious humanist theology, both Rees and Dietrich are in hot water with the traditionalists, and throughout both still separate denominations of Unitarianism and Universalism, there is a question as to whether humanists can continue preaching when there is no longer that strict message of Unitarianism, Universalism, or in other words, Christianity. But once again, the numbers speak for themselves. Too many people are identifying as one of the U's because they've heard religious humanism offered in their pulpits. As religious America is in decline in the 1960s, the Unitarians and the Universalists, both tiny compared to the Catholics and Protestants who are also losing congregants, but they are too big to fail. Our two root denominations can't risk such loss. And so now, what was a debate over Trinity versus unity 500, 1,000 years ago, or salvation for the elect versus a forgiving, loving God 300, 400 years ago, and then Bible and text versus constant, uncanonized revelation, now the debate becomes theism or humanism. And it is somehow out of this context were within this context of dissonance and questioning, of evolution and tradition, that really somehow in 1961, the Unitarians and the Universalists merge. Okay, it's not really somehow. It's actually money. In 1961, is this a depressing sermon? I'm just wondering now. It's our history. In 1961, the Unitarians and Universalists are both broke and in decline. But the Unitarians outweigh the Universalists 9-1 in bodies and in finances, which is why their name came first. They knew that within this 10-syllable tradition, we, in the grocery store line, at the Thanksgiving table, on your first date, were going to say, where do you go to church? Oh, Unitarian. And drop the Universalists. And it's also within this context that we realize there is no creed coming out of these people, right? Because the questions and the affirmations still haven't stopped. The Unitarians are still, let's do it like this. The Unitarians are still saying Jesus is human, but we believe in salvation for the elect. But they've also got the Transcendentalists mixed in. So now they're kind of Christians without Jesus being the Christ, and they are earth-based, while also having the humanist strain stuck in. And the Universalists, they're all about Jesus being God, but they're all going to heaven. Everybody's saved. And they've got the Transcendentalist influence, and they've got the humanists coming in. So we've got humanists mixed with Christians, Christians who believe in the Trinity but not in eternal damnation, and Christians who believe in eternal salvation but Jesus was only human. We've got Transcendentalists who just want to worship the earth and go out to the pond with Walden. We've got folks who think universalism is going to mean a universal for the world religion. We've got it all. And when people ask us now why we don't know what we believe, I want to remind you that this was only 50 years ago. That merger, that conglomeration is young. So instead, we've got these seven principles. First, there were six, and the seven still today are debated. They focus, though, on covenant, a promise, an affirmation of evolution, of all life, of individual process and communal need. They say, essentially, we need not think alike to love alike, which most people read and think anyone would get behind these, but they don't. Not in action, not in accountability to community, not as a set of standards for their religious faith or even for their secular being. Somehow, these principles are the result of this messy, rich history, a beautiful articulation of faith in action rather than faith in belief. They set out a utopia, certainly not that we live in, a beloved community, not that we have seen, but something that we, in saying yes to those seven principles and to that covenant as a Unitarian Universalist, something that we are always striving for, despite the difference that is inherent in who we are and who we have always been. Now, this is a lot of the history that I share in Roots. Can I get some head nods from the folks that have been in Roots? Is that right? Does this sound mostly familiar? Okay. See, and they've come back. They've come back. To the question of what do we believe, I can't answer that because what I believe doesn't negate me from being a Unitarian Universalist if you don't believe that. And if you believe something different as a Unitarian Universalist, that doesn't negate me from being one. But here's what I will do. I'm going to give you my elevator speech. Yeah, everybody knows what an elevator speech is. You get in the elevator, you're on the ground floor, we hope. You're going up to the ninth, maybe more, we hope, because now somebody has turned to you and asked, what does your chalice necklace mean, or what's that order of service in your hand? Here's what I say. We don't seek to answer many of the same questions most religions do. For us, it's not about who God is or what happens after we die. It's about who we are and what we'll do in this life. We're quite similar to Reformed Jews who recognize Jesus as a prophet or a teacher, but not a God. But we come out of a rich Christian tradition, so we sound and feel quite Protestant. We have no creed, which means we don't ask everyone to believe the same thing. But we do affirm and promise to affirm the worth and dignity of all life that we believe is made better by being in community. And at the end of the day, that affirmation is pretty much our charge, our purpose, and our holy work in the world. Hopefully it's a long elevator ride. So there's so much more. There are so many more good, rich, fascinating stories to learn. The chalice, why there are two circles that encompass the flame and why they are placed in the way that they are. How our youth were actually the ones who helped the merger along after 8 different tries throughout our history. How religious education has made Unitarian Universalism as our denomination today worthwhile. But for today, this is enough. And may the history of our people inspire you and inspire all of us to learn more with pride. Blessings and blessed be.